Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. One of the final acts of the Trump administration was the release of the 1776 Commission Report, a reading of American history released on the Martin Luther King holiday, which offered a hagiographic view of America's founding, which whitewashed our troubled racial history, absolving the Founding Fathers' views in defense of slavery, praising the lofty ideals of the Declaration of Independence and the U.S. Constitution while ignoring the less lofty actual practice of democracy in the 18th and 19th century. While equating efforts by ethnic groups and progressives to assert equal rights and opportunities in the 20th and 21st century to the white supremacists in the antebellum South who were dedicated to keeping and expanding slavery in the 1800s. The 1776 Commission, which historians have assailed as politics designed to stoke culture wars, seemed to be a direct rebuttal to the New York Times 1619 Project, which addressed America's history of systemic racism in a series of essays and articles. Already, the Biden administration has rescinded the commission and removed the report from the White House website. But it does point to a larger question of how we interpret our history and how we can learn from the past if we have very different views of that past. So on Inauguration Day, I spoke with Professor Brian Hosmer, professor of history and chair of the history department at Oklahoma State University, about the 1776 Commission report and how we move forward as a nation when we can't agree on the facts of the present or the past. Brian Hosmer, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Rich.
As a historian, you're very familiar with the conflicts and differing opinions inherent in interpreting history. But just as Americans have been dealing with dueling realities of facts over the last 40 years, are we seeing a greater divide in how we view our history?
Well, I think we may be seeing a greater divide. I mean, I think that the way we view history is inextricably linked with the other conflicts in our society. And so we have had a battle over truth and facts and even comportment and decorum and a number of things that have really driven Americans into, let's say, antagonistic camps. And so I think this report fits into that moment. It is an element. In fact, I would like to, I can begin by saying that reading this report in light of the inauguration today and the events of 2 weeks ago and then reaching back 4 years was in some ways a disorienting experience because it seems like a deliberate attempt to stoke cultural wars as opposed to helping us move beyond them. And it also reads as kind of almost immediately dated and a bit of a relic, right? I mean, it's a strange document that within, just a couple of weeks seems oddly out of place and out of the moment. But yeah, I mean, I think that understanding this in the context of the broader divisions makes a lot of sense. I'm not sure that we argue more about history or that it's more divisive. It may be more that the way we think about history is filtered through these other conflicts that we have in our society.
Let me ask you about some of the viewpoints put forth in this report. There were no professional historians on this commission, but there were educators, and there were conservative viewpoints represented in this document. Is this view common within educational circles, that we should view our history in this, what I would say is a hagiographic viewpoint of the founders and the documents that sort of are our founding documents?
Yeah, it certainly exists in the world of education and the world of scholarship. It's not new, and the debates around understanding history and what the the purposes of history are not new. And there are people in my profession in the education world who would hold very strongly to this view. Let me say that I don't have a problem necessarily with that perspective, so much as the kind of ahistorical nature of it. And so it's fine to have multiple and competing viewpoints on history. In fact, history is all about robust debate and all about different ideas about the purposes of history. What's in some sense missing here is really an appreciation for that whole process of doing history, that history is this pull and push and a search for deeper truths, you might say, through rigorous debate and peer review. I mean, I found it notable that this report has no footnotes, has no citations. You know, there are assertions made here, but without, in some cases, in many cases, support, which is ironic in a way because it represents a violation of some of the basic professional standards of doing history, which is that you cite your sources, right, and that you make transparent the kind of work that you do. And so, you know, this is at once a, you know, an appeal for a kind of traditional sort of history that doesn't have any footnotes, that doesn't cite sources, that makes a series of assertions. So arguing for a particular standpoint or a particular interpretation of history is legitimate. What is problematic is the effort to elide, to sidestep the kind of rigorous give and take that historians expect of one another.
I mean, as a polemic, I assume it's absolutely, or a piece of rhetoric, I suppose, it's perfectly legitimate.
Right.
Yeah. But the idea that it is a government-sanctioned report and it has within it a pretty evident implied criticism of education and historians that don't take a similar view of the history that it puts forth.
Correct. Right. And I thought it was interesting you used the word state history, because one of the other ironies is that it really takes issue with totalitarianism in a number of places and tries to link educators with different forms of totalitarianism, links progressivism with fascism and communism, and, you know, makes a number of really leaping generalizations, sweeping generalizations. And yet this report more closely resembles the kind of state history that we would see totalitarian regimes produce. It's the kind of thing that when reminds you of a kind of Bolshevik history or a Maoist history that was produced by the state. It is a state history. It was commissioned by the state and really acts in the service of a particular partisan agenda. So there's an irony there, right? That this, in some sense, resembles closely what the report purports to reject.
Hmm. One of the interesting things that this report does, it seems to be a direct rebuttal of the New York Times series of reports on their 1619 Project on how slavery and its consequences has been and remains at the center of our national narrative. I think most people who would observe history would say, well, yeah, that seems to be a fact. We can debate on how much of it, but certainly it is at a part of our national narrative. And it absolves founding fathers and the nation for falling far short of the rhetoric and ideals of the nation's founding. So what is your view of that viewpoint, that we should not ever criticize a historical figure or a historical document for falling short of what the ideals they propose, how they went through their own history, their own time?
Yeah, it's a fundamentally ahistorical approach to doing history. History is supposed to be critical. History is supposed to examine documents, supposed to rely on evidence. And this document suggests that there are individuals and documents in our history that cannot be criticized, that cannot be read critically and must be accepted in a certain way, right, and by a certain sort of interpretation. And that's a really deeply problematic notion in terms of practice of history. But, you know, you mentioned the 1619 Project. It is, I think, a direct effort to rebut that. But it leads to, right, this denial of a central feature of American history without which we can't really understand where we are and who we are. It's I would argue, impossible to understand American history absent race, dispossession, Jim Crow, all the rest. And this seems to suggest, right, that those were side things. Those were sort of inconvenient things, but really didn't matter very much, and that the framers of the Constitution were actually anti-slavery, and they actually had this idea of a more perfect union in mind. Well, I think that they probably did, but in practice, moving toward a more perfect union, a more inclusive society, was a matter of struggle. It was a matter of sacrifice. these rights that are described and that we hold dearly were not given. They came about. The democracy was extended through struggle and sacrifice. And that entire history, the history of oppression and racism, but also the triumph over those kinds of things, incomplete as it is ignored. And somehow, right, washed away with this idea that in 1787, a group of people had this perfect idea, and guess what? It worked its way out, just on its own. It's utterly ahistorical.
Yeah. Well, the idea that the writing and rhetoric may have been lofty, but I think anytime you examine rhetoric and, you know, writings, you also have to, any biographer does this, they account the writings with their actual actions.
Absolutely.
And the actions of the founders were very different. Many of them owned slaves. Some opposed slavery. Others held slavery and were very ambivalent and understood that they didn't necessarily in their hearts believe that that was right, but it was also an economic fact of their time.
Right. The document purports that the framers of the Constitution abhorred slavery. That's a sweeping generalization. They did not abhor slavery. They may have been uncomfortable with it. Some were opposed to slavery. John Adams was opposed to slavery. Jefferson, as you say, was ambivalent, but not so ambivalent that he wasn't willing to free his slaves. And even upon his death, the slaves remained enslaved. So to suggest that he was, in his heart, ambivalent or about slavery, or that slavery was abhorrent to him, doesn't comport with his behavior. It just doesn't.
My guest today is Brian Hosmer, professor of history and chair of the history department at Oklahoma State University. As today on Studio Tulsa, we discuss the divide and how we interpret American history in the wake of this past week's release of the 1776 Commission Report, one of the last acts of the Trump administration, which critiques how we view American history and offers a very different history. I think at one point they quote, a patriotic history. That's what we should be teaching. He's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Now, as I mentioned earlier, one of the first acts of the Biden administration was that report was removed from the White House website. It still exists. One question I have, and it's, why can we agree that in the modern era, we can certainly critically assess the shortcomings of, say, presidents or leaders? We balance the good versus not so good accomplishments they either achieved or failed to achieve. But when it comes to that, again, the Declaration of Independence or Constitution, we view those documents and the people who created them as sacrosanct. Mm-hmm. Why is acknowledging the humanness of those founders and those documents so troubling to some?
I think there's great fear, and I think there's fear of change and fear that society moves on, and that if we are not to regard the Declaration of Independence as sacrosanct, then somehow our society spins out of control and doesn't hold together anymore. I also think there's a deeper issue here, too, in that this is about power and the power of interpretation, and that conservative historians and educators are engaged in a question of power and interpretation, but also power in the here and now. And they object particularly to the notion of a living constitution, that these documents exist and are flexible. Because what that does is it opens the door for different kinds of policies, maybe things that they don't like. And the idea of holding these documents sacrosanct in a way is an effort to shut the door on change, on policy changes, on expanding democracy by simply saying that we can't do X, Y, and Z because it violates our founding principles, right? So there's a circularity to this logic that has a kind of serves a useful purpose for those who object to the changes in our own society today, to the expansion of rights, all the way to, you mentioned a little while ago, the 1619 Project that really has us think about slavery and racism as a core issue in American society. By referring to these founding documents as in some sense divinely inspired and that can never be read critically and never understood historically, what you do is you say that everything that happens later is somehow or can be regarded as illegitimate. And in fact, this report does that. It refers to policy changes that occurred during the Progressive Era and the New Deal and in the 1960s as essentially unconstitutional, un-American. And so what this is that the framing documents are used as a kind of lever, as a kind of a guard post that defines policies that a particular group in this country doesn't like as un-American. You mentioned a little while ago this notion of patriotism, a patriotic history. This is an element of this whole conversation because the implication is that patriotism has to be defined in a certain way, that love of country has to be understood as equivalent with certain political values and certain cultural values. And so that's a use of patriotism, a claiming of patriotism to valorize certain kinds of ideas and certain political persuasions. Well, understanding and arguing that the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution can't be interpreted, are not living documents, operates the same way. It is a claiming of history, and in fact, it's a claiming of legitimacy in the here and now.
I find always, it usually shows up in constitutional law, the idea of, is the Constitution a living document that evolves in time? Or, should we always go back to founders' intent? It really depends on, what the issue being argued is. I think back to, the McGirt decision. You had one justice who wrote the majority opinion who did believe in founders' intent and said, the Constitution says, if Congress didn't disestablish that reservation, it exists. And others say, no, you can't. Yeah, and the treaties are in force. And then you had others who are also sort of originalists who said, well, we can't really go back and redo all of this. And this whole idea of whether the words are set in stone and should never be reinterpreted for a changing world that is hundreds of years on from when those words were written, all depends on what the issue is and what's being argued.
It often does, but there's another element. I agree with you that different sides grab a hold of originalism in different ways according to their interests. But there are a couple of parts of this question of originalism that I've always found somewhat puzzling. One is the idea that we can discern the intent of the framers, and we know that the framers disagreed. They disagreed vehemently among themselves. And so to say that there was a single truth or a single interpretation is in some ways problematic, right? That there were differing opinions then. Another part of it is I'm not at all convinced that the framers intended the Constitution to be a straitjacket. They made provisions for amendments. They made provisions they had parts of the Constitution that were deliberately worded very vaguely with the idea clearly that this would be interpreted. I think that originalism, ironically, doesn't really give the framers enough credit for understanding that the document had to change over the course of time and or along with conditions that they couldn't possibly foresee. And so there's an irony there, too, right, that I think we're selling the framers short when we say that the words are set in stone and can never be interpreted. Moreover, I don't live in 1787. I don't know about you, but I'm old, but not that old. And so I accept the fact that there are conditions that were unforeseen at the time, and then we evaluate them. Now, the other side of it is it useful and important to have a set of principles that we work with? Of course, right? We need that. But I'm not convinced, as I said, that the Constitution was ever intended to be a straitjacket.
One of the other things that comes out on this report is, as a scholar who focuses on the history of Indigenous Americans and its relations and how Native Americans were treated in our society for decades and continue to this day, there's virtually no mention of American Indians.
Erased from the document.
Yeah.
Erased from this history. And which, to me, is heaping additional pain upon people who have been historically abused and continue to be now. There is another level of abuse being piled upon them. a further victimization, erasure from history, erasure from consideration. The suggestion that their experiences are inconsequential is another form of victimization piled right on it, and it's deeply troubling and deeply bothersome. And again, also ahistorical. From a standpoint of an historian, you're leaving out a big story. And there's again another irony that I noticed in the report. And one of the things that the writers of this report particularly objected to, again, comes out of the progressive era, where they started talking about laws and processes that seized property and redistributed it as a fundamental violation of individual rights and property owning. And they saw this as a turn in the wrong direction that happened after the Civil War, and particularly in the early part of the 20th century. That's an irony. What was the dispossession of American Indians other than the seizing of property and its redistribution to favored individuals, right? When I was reading this, I also had the feeling at times that irony is truly dead, right? that there were many, many points in this part where I thought, well, isn't that ironic, right? You're making this statement, and yet there's this giant story of redistribution, theft and redistribution, that somehow doesn't make it into here.
Right. It's interesting. You touched on one of the sort of center posts of this document, that all rights are individual, that group rights and group identities are, they equate them with fascism and, slavery, as putting another group at a detriment by a group identity and a group demand for equal rights, as if, Asian Americans were never thrown out of this country. Right. If Latino Americans were sent out, in the 1800s, lost their lands that they had historically owned. All of these group identities have suffered from another group saying, you don't have rights.
Exactly. And this elevation of individual rights over group identities, I think, is a very clever way of diminishing the struggles of various groups and the efforts of various groups to band together to secure the very liberties that this Constitution and our way of life promise. And it is also a clever way of ignoring the fact that, as you just said, that groups were targeted and were dispossessed and were abused. And so it's a strange but again a kind of clever way of diminishing all of the efforts by various groups to struggle to right wrongs. And in fact, one group identity that's not really discussed, it's discussed in a very strange way, is white identity and white supremacy. And that one is seemed to be as normalized, right? Not really discussed.
Well, it is mentioned in one particular part, yeah. and it is in the early to mid 19th century, mm-hmm. when all of the ills of society were placed on a group of Southern white gentlemen who basically were working to keep slavery as a part of this country. And so they do.
It's a very strange extrapolation.
Yes.
To me. I mean, the idea that John C. Calhoun is, the great grandfather of Black Lives Matter is a boy, a jarring, really, really jarring image that I'm struggling with, right? I mean, I think I see what they're trying to do with it, but you just shake your head, and I don't know many historians who would agree with that view.
You have to explain that a little bit further for those who have not read this document. The idea that John C. Calhoun, the Southern South Carolina senator, who was asking for nullification during the Jackson era, who was a staunch defender of slavery and actually advocating its continued expansion through the 1840s and 50s.
Right. So that's right. So Calhoun was a staunch defender of slavery. He was, arguing for nullification. He argued that rather than a necessary evil, slavery was actually a positive good. It was a positive thing. The authors of this document suggest that Calhoun's perspective was one of group rights, and that it was an effort to elevate the rights of whites over non-whites. Okay, that's fair, but then they make this leap and seem to argue that what Calhoun was arguing and Calhoun was propagating somehow finds its way into the 20th century, into the 21st century, with groups, you know, non-white people, people of color, various groups who are organizing to advance their own perspectives and rights. I find that to be, as I said, a jarring leap. I understand in a sort of general sense the argument they're making, but to use a proponent of white supremacy as the grandfather, as I said, of Black Lives Matter is, I think, deeply insulting. Yeah. And really doesn't speak to the entire sweep of history, which is really about expanding opportunity and expanding participation and the struggle to overcome precisely the systems of government and society that Calhoun was fighting to protect.
One last question. As I mentioned at the top of this, our conversation, you know, this was one of the last documents produced by the Trump administration, and it's you know, 2 days before the administration did. It's already gone from the White House website. But does this document have an influence beyond this sort of end of administration situation, much like you see last minute executive orders or pardons and clemencies?
Well, I think that some of the perspectives in this document will continue and are going to continue. Does the document have life? I don't think so. I think that it is so hastily put together and it is, you know, poorly argued that I don't think the document itself will live very long. It's a relic of the prior administration, and it will go away. Now, the fact that these debates over history and arguments over history are intertwined with current conversations about facts and truth and all of that, and I would argue power and influence, those will continue, but I don't think the document will have very, very long legs. And if the idea was that this would supplant the 1619 Project, I think that won't happen. I think that it will be a dismal failure for the people who put it together. I don't think it's going to last.
Professor Hosmer, Brian Hosmer, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Brian Hosmer is a professor of history and the chair of the history department at Oklahoma State University, speaking with us about the 1776 Commission report released by the Trump administration on Monday and rescinded by the Biden administration on Wednesday and Thursday. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.